Hi everyone, this is Dr. Whited. I'm doing, once again, my anonymous question episode, and these are anonymous questions submitted by my abnormal psychology, which I now call psychopathology class. I'd really love to do more episodes in between these anonymous question episodes. I have no shortage of ideas, but I have a severe shortage of time, so that's why that's not happening. But I do have some things. If you go to dohealthybehealthy.com/exercises, you can find a few relaxation exercises that I've put together. And I give these to patients and to basically anyone who's looking for some relaxation exercises to get them started on the path to using different relaxation exercises and stress management exercises throughout their day. I think these are things that can be useful to everyone. So go ahead and check those out. But without further ado, let me get into the anonymous questions for this summer. Hopefully I can do a second one of these if my students give me more submissions. And the class just started, so they probably haven't read much, if any, chapters before this. So they're wonderful questions coming completely blind, not just based on things that that are present in the book. So I'm really excited to answer these ones. So here we go. There's about 20 of them, so we're truly playing 20 questions, sort of. First one, being that it is June and Men's Mental Health Awareness Month, I'm curious to know why men struggle more when it comes to fostering their mental health, and also why men feel as if they have a harder time opening up about the things that they are dealing with. Well, I think there's two big reasons for this. One big reason is that the way that men are socialized. I'm a man as well. We are socialized to not express our feelings, to be quiet and stoic and powerful and take care of shit. And that's what is expected of us. So showing any vulnerability and emotion is often something that is not perceived well. It's not part of traditional masculinity. So for example, like, you know, the phrase man up or suck it up or things like that, there are things that men hear can hear frequently from their culture. Not everyone and not all the time, certainly not myself. That allowed me to become a psychologist, is having the ability to speak openly about my feelings and talk to other people about their feelings. So that being fostered in my life is what made this a possible career for me, but that's certainly not the case, and that's certainly not what our overall culture communicates to us in media and in other things. You know, men are very readily taught to be competitive, and so it's easy for us to call each other weak and things like that because to try to win this competition that we're all in. And again, this is not exclusive to men, but this is something that makes it more frequent among men to have difficulty expressing feelings because we're not socialized that way. We're not taught to talk about our feelings. We're taught to man up, suck it up, and move on and get shit done. That's really what is put forth to us. Now, that can be very helpful because sometimes our feelings are getting in the way. For example, anxiety. Anxiety gets in the way of things. It makes us not want to do stuff. It makes us want to avoid stuff. And to push through that anxiety and realize that that anxiety was lying to us. It's telling us we should be afraid of this because this might happen or that might happen. And then we go do it and we realize that anxiety was lying. Whatever we were afraid of happening didn't happen. And if it did, it wasn't the end of the freaking world. And our anxiety was telling us that we should avoid because it would be the end of the world. So there's a benefit to this, but not when it is applied wholesale across the board. We also need to be able to talk about feelings and emotions. So that's part of the challenge with men. Fostering their own mental health. We're also less likely to go to therapy and less likely to engage in that kind of thing. So that's another piece of it. Another piece of it is that the diagnoses are, you know, women are more likely to receive a psychological diagnosis, especially depression, anxiety, and things like that. But men sometimes express depression and anxiety in ways that are not the ways that those diagnoses are written. So for example, when it comes to feeling sad or down, you know, when things get in the way and we're trying to meet our goals and live the life we want to live, and things get in the way of that, it's natural to feel sad or down. But for men, often that manifests as aggression and frustration and anger, as opposed to feeling sad or down. It's kind of okay for us to express anger and rage socially, but a little less okay for us to express being sad and down. And so that's part of the reason there's a gender difference in those diagnoses, and part of the reason that it makes it harder for men because there aren't diagnoses that necessarily always fit the way that we express our feelings. So, great question. That was a really great one to start with. Thanks for that. Next question. How will this class relate to my future career as a social worker in the healthcare field? That's a great question. I wanted to answer this one and speak more generally about this because, you know, this is clearly a single person asking, an individual asking about this. But the question is broader. So why would a social worker take a psychology class? Why does a social worker care about diagnoses? And the truth is, all of us need to be able to identify psychopathology and apply diagnoses because that's part of getting reimbursement and that kind of thing. And it's also part of identifying what treatment works best. Social workers are trained differently from other mental health care practitioners, even though they do a lot of the same work. They're trained to really contact people with the resources that they need. And this is what is special about social workers that a lot of other mental health areas lack. And that is that they can apply to some of the social aspects of mental health. So I alluded to that in my answer to the last question, that there are social aspects to mental health, that it doesn't have to do with an inherent weakness among men. It has to do with how we are socialized and how we are taught to behave by what our culture reinforces for us, by what our interactions with other people tell us is okay or not okay, what's the norm and that kind of thing. So that's our environment, the people around us and the institutions around us are important. So social workers can help people get in touch with Medicaid. They can help them get on disability. They can help them contact a lot of these resources that are available that people might have trouble navigating on their own. So that is a special thing that they can do. They also do mental health treatment. The way social workers are trained, though, is to apply a similar intervention that really supports the other person's autonomy and helps them find solutions to the problems that they're having. Solution-focused care is one of the names for that. Now, that's helpful to everyone, but it's not going to treat mental health issues in the same way or as effectively as someone using empirically based treatments or science-based treatments. So for example, if I'm going to treat depression, I want to choose a science-based treatment. It's not just about supporting that person. It's about supporting them and helping them to, depending on the treatment, change the way that they conceptualize their problems, the way that they approach their problems, the way that they think and talk to themselves. So people with depression often speak to themselves in their head very negatively. And so helping them combat that. It could be a different treatment. Behavioral activation is my favorite, which involves having them identify what their life values are, identify the life they want to live, and take small steps toward that. And as they take small steps toward it, they realize that those steps are possible, and they start to feel better and pursue those steps without much help from a therapist, honestly. And so those are just two examples. There are many other ones. But that's where taking a class in psychology and in the science of behavior change is really helpful to a social worker because once they're licensed, they can go seek training in that. And I do some of this training around Greenville, North Carolina. I'll be doing a training in behavioral activation in February. We don't have the date set yet in February through the local area health education center, AHEC, AHEC. That's where we put on a lot of the secondary education because when we graduate and get licensed in any field, social work included, our training's not done. We still need to learn to do the things well that we need. And especially for folks with a master's level training, they need to learn what treatments are going to be best for what problems. They have a great base in general treatment, but you can add to that by getting these science-based treatments. So I say that's the best way that classes in psychology and in psychopathology can be helpful to someone who's pursuing social work or another master's level licensure. Next question. I'm curious as to why some mental health medications are labeled as one thing when they are prescribed for multiple purposes. For example, if someone were diagnosed with depression or anxiety, but are prescribed something medically labeled as an antipsychotic or an anti-seizure medication, why not just label it for multiple purposes if it serves to aid multiple purposes? Well, the reason for this is complicated and more far on the pharmacological end of things. So things have certain indications based on what they have FDA approval for, and that is generally based on a lot of research. So if they can demonstrate through research that something is effective for a mental health issue, then it can get approved for that, basically. Sometimes things that were originally developed for another purpose seem to help with mental health issues. So antipsychotics are usually used to treat things like hallucinations and delusions, part of like schizophrenia or other problems that have that kind of those psychotic features, hallucinations, delusions, and the things that accompany those. So that's usually what antipsychotics are used to treat. But what people found through research is that for people who are really struggling with depression and have received other types of treatment, sometimes adding on an antipsychotic or an anti-seizure medication can be helpful because they work on parts of the brain that are different when people are experiencing very severe depression. Now, there are better treatments for depression for people who are not experiencing severe depression for a long period of time. So these add-on treatments are for folks that have pretty severe issues. And have not been real responsive to other treatments, and other treatments including antidepressants, the typical ones, usually SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which increase the amount of serotonin in the synapses of the brain. And so when those aren't working well enough, then sometimes they use an add-on treatment instead of just upping the dose further or switching. And that's where you see antipsychotic or sometimes anti-seizure medications. I can't quote to you all of the neurobiology behind it, as I'm not a neuroscientist or a psychiatrist whose wheelhouse this is. I'm more on the behavior change aspect through therapy, and that sort of thing is my expertise. That's basically what's happening. You're working on a different neurotransmitter. Antipsychotics usually are working on dopamine and things like that. Anxiety is interesting because the SSRIs, which are thought of as antidepressants, actually work for anxiety as well, but they have to be prescribed in higher dosages, and then sometimes that means that people get are more likely to have the side effects from it, like some various discomfort side effects and sexual side effects. All right, good question. Next one. I do not have a question, but more of a desire to develop a better understanding of treatments for borderline personality disorder. Growing up with a close family member suffering from this disorder has made me not as compassionate as I could be. To speak briefly on it, borderline personality disorder is difficult to interact with people who especially have a severe form of the disorder. So borderline personality disorder is a really chronic fear of abandonment and engaging in a lot of behaviors to try to forestall that abandonment. And a cacophony of other challenges as well. People with borderline personality disorder, like most people with personality disorders in this cluster, tend to be very emotional, very outwardly expressive with emotion, and very intense, and almost seeming fickle with their emotions. Like they might be feeling happy and loving towards someone at one point, and then if that person does something negative, then that person is suddenly the worst person and a bad person, an evil person, and people can flip-flop depending on their current behavior. Now, this can seem manipulative. Again, like I said, they're trying to keep relationships because of this fear of abandonment and using these kind of maladaptive strategies to do that. But it is truly how these folks feel. Like this is an issue of not having experiences, validating experiences to understand their own inner world. So they really seek others to validate who they are. They have an unstable sense of identity and knowing who they are and what they're feeling and what they're about. They're more about trying to get and maintain relationships. And if someone gives hints of abandonment in any way, often their response is to push that person away fully before they can reject them. So it can be difficult, as you might imagine. It's difficult to work with folks with more severe borderline personality disorder in therapy, and they're difficult to have a close relationship with. But this is actually a rather treatable problem. You know, personality disorders develop over time from a young age and are around for a long time. So that just if something has been around for a long time, it's going to be harder to treat. It's going to be harder to learn to be different when you've been a certain way for a long period of time. And usually this is due to early life experiences and in addition to a little bit of a predisposition. And so folks with borderline personality disorder can really benefit from something called dialectical behavior therapy. If you're in my class, I'll do a whole lecture on it. But this is basically a suite of skills to help them be able to interact with others better. So for example, teaching them that when they're upset with someone, when they're mad at them, instead of rejecting them and running away and doing kind of self-injurious things to get their attention, to draw them back in, maybe having a conversation with them is better. and helping them to know how to have that conversation, to tell them what their need, to tell the person what their needs are, have a discussion with them. That's something people with borderline personality disorder generally haven't learned. They haven't had the opportunity to learn something like that. And so that's one tiny piece of this therapy. It's a very large thing. I can't go into all of it to answer this question briefly. But dialectical behavior therapy is a very good treatment for borderline personality disorder, and probably the only one that really works well. So that would be the thing to look into. And compassion is difficult when we are experiencing some of these behaviors from someone with borderline personality disorder. But one of my overall principles that guides me in therapy is that everyone is doing the best they can with what they have to work with. Like, people with mental health issues have mental health issues because of things outside of their control. They've responded in the best way that they could with the knowledge that they have, with the experiences that they've had, with the biology and the behavior that they have. They're doing the best that they can. So what they need is more stuff to work with. If they're doing the best they can with what they have to work with, then the solution is to give them more stuff to work with. More skills, more ways of seeing things, sometimes changing their biology through medication, although that doesn't work real well with borderline personality disorder. And just doing those things to help them change. So that helps me with compassion, that knowing that my background looks at someone's behavior and says, well, they should just do this. But the reason I know that is because I had a background and experiences and challenges that taught me to overcome things in a certain way. And they have not had that. They may know how to overcome things, but just not these ones, or not in the way that's going to work in this situation. They probably know how to overcome things in ways that work in other situations, but the one they're currently in, it doesn't work. But they don't know anything else, so they're going to try the thing that doesn't work and keep trying it, and it's going to keep not working, and then they're going to get real sad about it. It's very natural. Like, the development of mental health issues is actually pretty natural, you know, barring ones that have a strong biological influence, like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia and things like that. Barring those, these developments are very natural. They're our natural response because everyone is doing the best they can with what they have to work with. So when I find myself losing compassion, I try to remember that, you know, folks are a product of them interacting with the people around them and other things in their environment, this culture that they live in. And there's not really a lot of options in ways you can be when you're influenced by all that stuff. And so they need someone or something else to intervene and help them to get the skills they need to be different and be healthier and happier. I'm a psychologist, so thankfully that's where I come in. I can help give them those skills. But if you're just trying to generate compassion, remember that everyone's life is different. And if you see a solution or a way that they should be different that would make their life so much better, you see that because you were fortunate enough to have the experiences that you've had that they probably haven't. Next question. Can someone have many mental breakdown and feel sad and not have depression? Mental breakdown isn't really something we use within psychological literature, so it's hard for me to understand what people mean by that. Can they feel sad and not have depression? So depression is just a list of symptoms. And if you have enough of those symptoms, then you have depression. People think of depression as this disease that lives within them and every once in a while rears its ugly head and attacks them from inside. That is not what depression is. Maybe people with severe depression that have a strong genetic predisposition and have had pretty bad life circumstances, it can really feel that way because they have, you know, don't have a lot of control over it, and it doesn't take much to cause them to feel depressed. But if someone for 2 weeks or more experiences a depressed mood, and anhedonia, which means a lack of interest in the things that they typically enjoy or a lack of pleasure when they do engage in those things. Two, if they have one or both of those, plus a few other symptoms like weight loss or gain, too much or too little sleep, concentration issues, suicidal ideation, and a few other ones. I think if it equals up to five, if you can count five, then they have depression. So depression is not some thing that lives within. It's just a description. This is what's weird about mental health diagnoses. They're just a description. They don't tell you anything about where that depression comes from, why that person's feeling depressed, what has led them here, what life circumstances, what life experience, what biology, what social aspect, what culture they live in, how they interact with that culture. It doesn't say anything of that. None of that is in the diagnostic criteria. It's just, do you meet those list of symptoms? So sure, someone can have a lot of sadness but not meet criteria for depression because they only feel depressed for a day or two and then they push past it. And depression is defined as having that problem for 2 weeks or more. They could not have depression because it doesn't interfere with their daily life. They may feel sad and down and have a rough day every now and then, but it doesn't interfere with anything, so it doesn't count. So depression is a list of symptoms and stuff. So, you know, so my answer to this question is kind of yes, kind of no, which is my answer to most questions, but I try to give you the informed reason why that's true. So that's basically why. Next question. Do Cerberus animals actually provide comfort and more happiness to people who use them for anxiety or depression reasons? They do help people to feel comfort. My concern with service animals is that people try to get them just so they can take their animal to places. And they try to get them for reasons that are probably not helpful to them in the long term. Again, everyone's doing the best they can with what they have to work with. So this is what the solution that people are seeking because they see that as a solution, and I respect that. But at the same time, in the long term, it's probably not going to help a lot with anxiety or depression because what you're creating is a crutch, or what we call them are like a safety signal. So it'd be like if you're anxious in social situations and you're just terrified of going to hang out with people, but you have like a safety person who makes you feel safe and makes you feel comfortable in social situations and you can go if they go with you. Well, that can be helpful to get you to go a little bit, but then you've got that safety signal that you need in order to overcome those anxious thoughts and anxious feelings. And that's not going to be helpful in the long term. That person's not always going to be available. Sometimes that person's going to see someone they know, and they're going to want to go talk with them, and they're going to leave you alone at that party, and you're going to have to figure out what to do. So those are the kind of things where service animals can hold people back. So I have some concerns about them, but I'm not an expert in this area. They're not an empirically based, a science-based treatment for anxiety and depression. They may help someone feel better, certainly, but they're not going to treat these problems. They'll remain even with a service animal. I just hear a lot of stories from colleagues who are like someone shopping around for therapists to try to get someone to write them a letter that they can have a service animal. And that's by and large something I wouldn't do. Like if someone asked me for a service animal, I wouldn't do it because I feel like it would interfere with the treatment that I'm probably providing. Next question. How can someone who struggles with mental health affect their family members? And how should we comfort the family? So depending on the mental health issues that someone is having, that can be disruptive. We had the example of borderline personality disorder earlier. And so I think it's best for family members to be supportive of that person getting treatment and improving. Family members tend to try to enact tough love a little too much, which tough love is not helpful. Tough love is like saying things like, you know, you really need to get your shit together, and just, you know, telling someone you need to be better and fix, you can't be sad all the time, you can't be anxious all the time, you've got to get out there and do things, you can't just hide, you can't, you know, that's what people call tough love. It doesn't help. Tough love, benefits the person who is giving the love, so to speak. I put air quotes around that you can't see. It benefits the person who's doing the loving, but not the person who's receiving it. It's a good way of being like, I don't want to help you anymore, but I want to feel like I help. So I'm going to tell you how it is. And then you won't listen. Then I can just sit back and be like, well, I told them. And that's not helpful. What's helpful is actually supporting someone. So if someone has a lot of anxiety, then being like, well, how can I support you in doing the thing that you're afraid of doing? How can I support you in getting the treatment that you need? How can I support you? So that can be a burden on family, like definitely. But the best thing you can do is help that person change. Again, everybody's doing the best they can with what they have to work with. And so you need to give them more to work with. Give them more support, give them more care, give them more resources. That's how you support someone in your family who's struggling. Then how do we comfort the family? Same way. If you know a family who one of the people in the family is struggling with mental health issues, then support that family. Say, hey, what can I do for you? Or, hey, you want to spend some time together? You want to hang out? You want to go have fun? You want to do this? How can I support you? That's the thing to do. Not to give them a hard time, and to talk to them about how the other family member is doing. This can be more challenging when you've got a family member with, for example, schizophrenia or something like that, where they're losing touch with reality periodically and things like that. That can be real stressful for a family. And again, just they need your support. They need the best they can. They're doing the best they can with what they have to work with. So give them more to work with. Give them your comfort and your support and you as a resource. Next question. In a professional setting, many employers have observed that some employees are increasingly disengaged from their assigned responsibilities, or that workplace culture has become less positive. Have there been notable changes in employee attitudes, behaviors, or expectations over the last 5 years that could explain these shifts? Well, this is a question that is far outside my expertise. There's an area of psychology called industrial organizational psychology. It's like psychology of the workplace, kind of. They study these things. I don't know if there have been big shifts in the last 5 years. I think that some of the key components in any position for making it useful, though, is having a wage that is commensurate with what the person's work. So if people are, the baseline level of things is having the person compensated appropriately, they're being paid what that work is worth, and having opportunities for advancement and things like that if they would so choose. So kind of having that baseline level of like a safe, happy workplace that is conducive to doing good work and getting compensated appropriately for that work. That's kind of the baseline. Things beyond that are a little more varied and pretty widely studied, but not something I could quote you on. And those are things like paying people extra doesn't make them happier, but creating an environment that they enjoy working, having more social aspects to their work for some people especially, is going to be helpful. But again, like those are more varied depending on the field and the career and all that kind of stuff. So I can't answer that too well. But I would say things have probably shifted in the last 5 years in terms of opportunity that people see through their work and things like that. Pay disparities have increased between upper level employees and lower level employees in terms of, when I say upper and lower level, I mean in terms of pay scale and in terms of like how long they've been with the company and what kind of training background they have. So those things have certainly changed in the past 5 years or so, which could just lead to disillusionment with work. I mean, people were taught to see work as the most meaningful thing that we do, but a lot of times it is not. And so people are just going to work to do their thing and make their money. That's where people can be disengaged from their responsibilities. Like it's not something that is value driven for them. It's work isn't always something that is like rewarding and part of them being the person that they want to be, other than giving them money to continue to survive and perhaps do the things that they really want to do. Sorry, I couldn't answer that one as well, but I did my best. Next question. How young is too young in order to start prescribing medications for anxiety and depression? And if a child is prescribed them at a young of age, how likely is it that the person to experience, how likely is that person to experience negative mental health as an adult, as that coping skill is essentially taken away in the formative years? Medications, I looked this up a little bit. I usually try to do these off the top, but this one was pretty important. So I did look this up a little bit. And for most medications prescribed to children are prescribed by child psychiatrists and other people with specific child mental health expertise. And so it's a very careful consideration because you're putting a medication into a developing brain. And so we want to be sure that that is not going to mess with development. And what this question also brings to the table is, you know, should basically we be teaching children other coping skills instead of using a medication to give them that? Well, the thing is medications and coping skills can be combined as well, I will say. We're much less likely to do that for children because, again, developing brains, we don't want to mess with that if we don't have to. If a child is experiencing severe anxiety, giving them a medication to reduce that anxiety in the long run, not something like a Xanax or something like that, that, you know, they take right before they go into a social situation, but giving them something that is like an SSRI that is continuously on board, then that makes it easier for them to do that, get into that social situation, and then maybe that's helpful then that they can learn the skills that they need in that social situation. That's generally not recommended for anxiety, but theoretically that is something that can be done. to be helpful. Same with depression. You know, if it's, a lot of times the treatment for depression involves getting a child like engaged in things that they care about and helping them to overcome those sad and demotivated feelings and move on and do things that are going to make them feel good. So maybe some antidepressants could help by improving their mood a little bit so that they can then engage in the things that they care about. So that does help to teach a coping skill. The key is to get that child off of the medication as soon as they don't need it anymore, which is the biggest problem with medication in our prescribing world. Because remember, the folks that prescribe medications are not the same folks that teach that would teach a kid the coping skills, right? So from their perspective, they prescribe a medication, the person gets better, it's because of the medication. Why would they want to stop it? Because those providers are not always as connected to the folks who are teaching kids the coping skills and the behavior change. So that becomes the real challenge. That's why good collaborative care is important. Whenever I'm seeing a patient who's seeing a psychiatrist, I get in touch with that psychiatrist. I mean, I don't work with children, but that's important. I want the information, but two, just to give updates and say, this person's doing really well, you know, and then if the patient wants, I encourage the patient to request a reduced, medications, just to, you know, reduce side effects, reduce any, feelings of dependence on them or anything like that. So, I think that communication is essential, but it's hard to do. And, you know, I completely respect prescribing providers' perception and, viewpoint that, you know, the medication is doing something. So should we really be removing that? So usually I try to engage in a discussion to determine collaboratively, is this a good time to either cut back on the dosage or stop medication or something like that. And there are very strong rules and regulations about what to prescribe children for anxiety, depression. So that's the child psychiatrists really know that. They're steeped in that literature and that understandings, and they follow those as closely as they can. Now, you know, when it comes to medications for other things like ADHD, that's prescribed much more readily because the effect on development is minimal, and it is something that really helps someone to develop coping skills and study strategies and all those kinds of things that they'll need. So that is helpful for coping skills in particular. But this question is about anxiety and depression. So next question, what are ways to manage stress and anxiety? And then second question, I've heard there's a healthy level of anxiety and a concerning level. How do you know when anxiety is not healthy? Great questions. How do you manage stress and anxiety? So stress is different from anxiety. Stress is just when our resources are taxed. And there is good stress too. stress is pressure and competition and things like that that make us try hard and do well. And so that kind of stress and anxiety are good. That's considered positive stress. If if our demands aren't pushed, then we will never rise to meet that. We are overstressed or stressed out, or however you want to say that, when our ability to meet those demands exceed the demands. Because then we can't see solutions to our problems, or maybe we can't, even if we could see solutions, solve our problems at all, or overcome the challenges in front of us at all. That's when we feel stressed out or overwhelmed or burnt out or things like that. And so that's how you tell with stress, when it's bad and when it's not. Anxiety is very similar. Anxiety is normal. We should feel anxiety. That is our body telling us we need to pay attention to stuff. If I didn't feel anxiety, I'd probably never do anything on time because that's what prompts me to be like, oh crap, that's due. I got to get it done. That's a good amount of anxiety. That is a healthy level. Being concerned or worried before you give a speech or do something where you might be embarrassed or doing any of those things, all of that is healthy anxiety. It's normal. If you're a human, you have anxiety. We're just apes with anxiety. That's what we are. And it's normal. Apes probably have anxiety too. Other apes. So there is nothing wrong with anxiety. When it's concerning is when it reaches a level that it impairs our functioning. Now, when I say impairs our functioning, I mean we start to avoid stuff entirely or escape things entirely due to anxiety, as opposed to pushing through them with a moderate level of anxiety and feeling good afterwards and feeling more capable of taking care of it the next time it comes around. So giving a speech, terrifying the first time, but we push through it and we do it and we feel accomplished at the end. And then we feel probably still anxious, but more ready to do the next one. That's healthy anxiety. When it's concerning is then when we start to do things to skip that. So if we have to give a speech in a class, we skip that class. We ask the teacher for a different assignment instead of giving a speech. Things like that. All of those kinds of things are where it's starting to meet a concerning level. And when we're feeling anxious at rest. So nothing's happening, nothing really going on, but we're feeling anxious and scared for some reason. And it's impairing our functioning and our ability to feel good. That's when it's starting to get to unhealthy anxiety. Obviously, meeting criteria for a mental health diagnosis in the anxiety spectrum, post-traumatic stress disorder, panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, things like that. Meeting criteria for those is probably a good indicator that anxiety is at a concerning level, but baked into all of those diagnoses is the fact that the level of anxiety is causing impairment or extreme distress. So that's how you tell. How do you manage it? With anxiety, you do the thing that you're afraid of until you feel better at it, and you just keep doing it. That's how to beat anxiety, basically. Managing stress is to try to keep your demands to a reasonable level, but always be pushing yourself. So you don't want to keep them to so low a level you're not experiencing much stress. You want to keep pushing yourself because that's how you teach your mind that you're capable of doing more. If you're holding back because you feel like you're not capable, that's not a good way of managing stress. If you're holding back because if you do more, you're going to have to take away from other things, like you have to stop spending time with friends, sleep less, that's not a good way of managing. So that's where how to manage stress. For both of these, something that helps but is not a treatment in and of itself are relaxation exercises. Breathing exercises to calm the body, mindfulness to calm the mind and body. Those kinds of things are very helpful. And everyone manages stress in different ways, but everyone should try those on for a while to see what works for them and then try them on again later in life when they experience stress in a different way to see if they work then. And as I mentioned at the top of this podcast, if you want to try those out, there's some on my website, dohealthybehealthy.com/exercises. And I will say my site's not monetized. It's just a place I put stuff. I used to have a Patreon, but I dropped it because I felt like it wasn't cool to be asking people to monetize this. I just want to give this away. So I don't make any money. There's no ads or anything. So it's just there for you. I'm not telling you this to try to make money is what I'm saying. Since I give my students extra credit for listening to this podcast, I have to give that disclaimer. Next question. Do you believe that patients get epilepsy or trauma to the brain like a car accident have a greater chance at having severe mental disorders? Do I believe that? To a degree, yes. I think the research does support that. Epilepsy, I don't think so. In terms of epilepsy causing mental health issues, like it doesn't hurt the brain in a way that causes mental health issues. Having to cope with epilepsy, that does cause challenges. Like someone can get depressed because they can't drive, they can't do the things that other people do, for example. And again, epilepsy is very variable. Some people with epilepsy can drive and they're everything. So, but for example, if they couldn't, then that means that they could develop depression or things like that. So they might be more likely to because of the lack of resources. Trauma to the brain, similarly, if there's damage that causes an impairment, that can a greater chance of having a mental health issue. Now, this question, having severe mental disorders, I would say no. When I think of severe mental disorders, I think very strong, very severe depression. Less severe depression, I'm not really lumping into that, but very severe depression, especially if they have psychotic features along with that, where they experience hallucinations, delusions, and other catatonia and other issues with it. Bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, these brain trauma and epilepsy, as far as I'm aware, do not increase risk for those severe ones, that I noted. Those have other factors that drive them a little more strongly, much more strongly. So probably not much of those being a big risk factor, at least that I'm aware of. Next question. What happens to cause people to lose the ability to experience natural happiness to resort to drugs and alcohol? Again, I'm going to go back to what I said before. Everybody's doing the best they can with what they have to work with. So people that have not learned to experience that or have not had the opportunity. So people who are living day to day, trying to survive and really focused on survival less than thriving or meeting their larger goals. They're just trying to make sure they've got food to eat and a place to sleep and all those kinds of things. When drugs or alcohol do give a feeling of positive emotional feelings like they do, then that is the only way people have to cope. And so some people can do that in a way that doesn't lead to an alcohol or substance use disorder. But for a lot of people, it might, because all of these, most drugs and alcohol do have tolerance and withdrawal, meaning that people need more to get the same feeling after a while. And if that's their go-to way to cope and they're doing that every day, they're going to develop some tolerance. They're going to develop withdrawal when they're not using it. And the only way to cure withdrawal is to either stop using the substance and wait, or to use a substance again. And so it does perpetuate itself as well once people are exposed to it. So that's why, you know. Next question, is everyone capable of developing an abnormal psychological disorder? I would say yes. I think that to some degree, if people are put in certain situations, then yes, pretty much everyone is capable of developing a psychological disorder. Especially when it comes to depression and anxiety. Depression and the anxiety disorders. When I say anxiety, I mean the anxiety disorders. There's no diagnosis called anxiety. But the anxiety disorders, things like panic disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, specific phobias, all those kinds of things, I think anyone could develop one of those given the right circumstances. That doesn't mean everyone will. I think it's like 30-some percent of people will meet criteria for a psychological disorder at some point in their life. I have that right? Depends on the group, but I think that's around, it's around that for the general population. So that's a lot of people, but I think if circumstances are a certain way, you'll see more. Look at COVID. During the COVID pandemic, we saw an increase in anxiety disorders and we saw an increase in depression, major depressive disorder. These things went up. That's an environmental change that affected a lot of people in a lot of ways. People lost jobs. People had to stay home. People, you know, lots of different things changed. And lots of people who probably wouldn't have developed a psychological disorder during that time did because those circumstances changed in such a way that it was really hard to deal with. It was hard for everyone to deal with. Some people had more resources than others. But it was hard for everyone to deal with. So we were all stressed, but then more people developed a mental health disorder. So I think everyone is capable given the right circumstances. Luckily, a lot of people have the experience, background, resources, and biology to avoid having those experiences throughout most of their life. But, you know, most of us do experience, if not a full-blown diagnosable psychological disorder, something close to it throughout our life. Next question. Why does grief seem to affect people at different times? Are mental health assessments always done through asking questions, or can you use x-rays or medical methods? What is one way to tell a difference between a normal amount of stress and anxiety? So I answered the third question already, so I'll leave that one alone. But the first two, so why does grief seem to affect people at different times? Well, everyone grieves differently. And we have a diagnosis now called prolonged grief disorder, where people are grieving in a way that is for a very long period of time compared to what we would consider normal grief to be. And they're grieving in such a way that it really interferes with their daily functioning. Now, grief should interfere with our daily functioning for a period of time. That is normal grief. But when that lasts for a very long time, it's something that could use some treatment. And we have good treatments for grief. They usually involve helping the person to, you know, they might talk and speak like they are fighting against that person being having died or having passed, or they're speaking in ways that they're still around or things like that. And so it helps them to come to terms with that and create meaning from that. Like, what is the meaning of that person's life? What are all the positive aspects of their life instead of being focused just on the fact that they have died? You know, what have you gained from being part of them? What did they gain from you? How will you honor them in the future? And this can come at different times. You know, some people are very, like, I'm a very get stuff done person. I don't feel the feelings until the crisis is over. So when I lose someone, I am taking care of the rest of the family. Depending on how close I am to them, I'm taking care of funeral stuff. I'm helping as much as I can. I live far away from a lot of my family, so I don't get to help as much as I would like, but I help as much as I can. And then once that's done, then I feel all the feelings. Then it hits me of like, this person's gone. And then that comes back too, at certain times. Like, we will feel that around holidays, around their birthday, sometimes around the date that they died, or when we're around things that remind us of them. But then what hopefully changes over time is that grief becomes more joy. So when I experience things that remind me of people that I've lost, like grandparents and other family members and aunts and uncles, that kind of thing, I like it. It reminds me of things I've done with them. And even though I miss them, it's a bittersweet feeling. Even though I miss them, it helps me to remember all those good times. That's a healthy grief response. Not to tout my own mental health, but I'm okay at losing people, I guess. But you can see how it might hit people at different times and affect them at different times. And there's nothing wrong with that unless it's severely interfering with their life over a long period of time, meaning that it's consistent for periods of time. It's fine for us to take days off for a few years after losing someone on the date of their birth, or on another special day. That's fine. Sometimes we need that. Then what we do with that time is hopefully celebrating their life, thinking of them positively, remembering all the wonderful things. And that can bring a lot of tears, but that doesn't mean we're necessarily sad about it, necessarily dwelling on the negative of that they're gone. We're kind of celebrating the things that we had that we'll never have again. And that's okay. The second part of this question, are there assessments always done through asking questions, or can you use x-rays or medical methods? There are no medical methods for diagnosing pretty much any of the mental health issues in the diagnostic manual. There are a few little things here and there, but there's pretty much nothing. We know that there are biological differences, but none of them are diagnostic. We can't look at them and say, oh, your brain is doing this, you have depression. That doesn't exist. The National Institute of Mental Health wants you to think that we'll eventually get there. Maybe we will, but they spent an entire decade and a lot of money studying it and didn't really find anything diagnostic. So right now it's done through asking someone their experiences. And look at the symptoms, like I mentioned the symptoms of depression before, that qualify someone for having major depressive disorder. That is... those are very much things that people tell you. You can also do observations. You can have them fill out surveys that systematically ask them about things. You can do structured interviews. So even though you're not just asking questions willy-nilly, you've got a specific way of doing that to make sure you're arriving at the right diagnosis. So there are things that are much more concrete than just kind of having a conversation and asking questions. We all do some structure to our clinical interviews when we're trying to determine a diagnosis. Depending on how much our goal is determining a diagnosis versus figuring out how to treat someone and what problems they're experiencing. So there are more discrete ways, but there are none that are discreet enough as doing x-rays or some kind of scan. Next question. Why do some people develop anxiety or depression and others don't, even if they go through similar things? Why do people that have been through trauma hang on to it for so long and can't get past it? So everyone's doing the best they can with what they have to work with. That's the answer to this question. So I'll skip over the first part. I've talked about anxiety and depression a lot. Let's go to trauma. So trauma is a little bit special because it writes itself on the brain a little differently. So we all have experienced traumatic, not everyone. Most of us have experienced traumatic events. And these are situations where we feel for at that time that our life is in danger, that someone else's life is in danger, or something very bad could have happened, even if it didn't, and often it does, but even if it didn't, that we feel like something terrible could have happened, usually involving death, or severe bodily injury or an affront, like a sexual assault or rape or something like that. So anything like that is considered trauma. Car accidents, those kinds of things. Not every car accident is traumatic, but they can be. So some people are equipped to overcome that. And the pivotal period seems to be in the, 2 to 3 months after the traumatic event. These events will always stick with us. I was in a car accident. Every once in a while, it comes flashing back to me. Or I watch a car accident on TV, and just the way that it plays out was similar enough to mine that I'm like, ooh, that's in my head. And it makes me, it feels worse than any other car accident I might see that has no similarity to mine. So that is kind of normal. Our brain remembers scary stuff. I mean, think about our ancestors who were trying to survive day to day and didn't have all the tools and resources. They had similar, very similar brains, but they didn't have the tools and resources in society that we have now. They were just trying to survive. And so their brain's telling them to stay the heck away from stuff that's scary and dangerous. That's a good thing. That's what keeps them alive long enough to, spread their progeny down the line to get to us. So for them, it was a survival tactic. To us, it's kind of annoying, but it is what it is. So that's why it's written on our brain a little differently. So when people have post-traumatic stress disorder, where they're having things like flashbacks and mood disturbances and cognitive disturbances in their thinking is what I mean when I say cognitive disturbances. When they're having all those experiences, that's because that trauma is really stuck. And it's, we have some, we can see differences in how it's stored in the brain when people lie in a brain scan and think about the trauma versus think about something else. Like it's in there a little differently. They're experiencing it like it is happening right now. Their body and mind are experiencing it like it's happening right now. Even if they're not having flashbacks where they really think they're there again, even if they're just like thinking about the trauma itself, that it feels like part of it feels like they're there again. And so what you have to do, and the thing is that trauma, those memories insert themselves into the person's day. They're sitting there going throughout their day, something reminds them of it, or sometimes it's unbidden, and that trauma inserts itself and they feel like they're there again in some ways. What happens is that's the only way they experience that memory. They experience it as something that is forced on them, that they can't control. And so the way to get through it is to engage with that memory in a way that is safe. So there are various different therapeutic techniques for this, but it's engaging with the trauma and what happened, and sometimes processing it in a way to talk it through and realize what they've learned from it, how they're different from it, how they're stronger for it, the effects that it's had on them, both positive and negative. So they're chewing on that memory in a way that is not just like, oh gosh, that memory, I need to escape. The other way is to actually literally engage with that memory. So to sit there and re-experience it and think through it, but at your own will and volition. And that exerts control over it. And then you pick it up and you play with it and you look at it and then you put it away. So you're in control of it. You're pulling it up and putting it back. And that helps rewrite it a little differently in the brain. Both of those examples I gave, too. I'm alluding to something called prolonged exposure therapy, and cognitive processing therapy, which are the two best therapies for post-traumatic stress disorder. You'll hear about other ones, especially EMDR, which is not as good as the others and doesn't work for the reasons that people think it does. So I would avoid that one and find something better if you can. But trauma is, that's why trauma is there. Again, we're doing the best they can with what we have to work with, and some people's minds and brains and their resources and experiences make it so that they can't forget these things and let them go. And so that's how therapy helps. And obviously, our natural response is to run away from these feelings and thoughts and memories. But as I just mentioned, the therapies are to kind of run toward them and discuss them, think about them, or experience them in a way that gives us control and power over them and changes the way that they're written in our brain. And then they don't have that kind of power anymore to just jump into our consciousness when they want to. But again, like I said, some of that is normal. Like for me, having that reminder of that car accident every once in a while, but the weird feelings only last for like a minute. And so that's just my brain being my brain. That's not PTSD. That's not a problem. That's normal. So, but if that would like take over my life, make me afraid of driving, I would think about it every time I went to drive or saw a car and couldn't watch any movies with cars or anything like that. Then it would be a problem. Then it would probably meet criteria for PTSD. All right, just a few more questions. We're almost there. Next one. How is the body affected during a panic attack? What happens to the brain during this? So during a panic attack, and again, this is in the anxiety spectrum. PTSD is its own thing, but it's related to the anxiety disorders. So it's a similar thing where our body is asserting this this kind of presence in our consciousness. So suddenly, everything is about what is our body doing. Now, something like 60% of people have one panic attack in their life, and then that percentage goes down as the number increase. So this is just some weird haywire thing that our body does occasionally. Usually it's under high stress and we have an isolated panic attack. For people with panic disorder, it's not an isolated event. It's not triggered necessarily. It can come up as, it can come up randomly. People might wake up with panic attacks. They're not having dreams or anything. It just happens. So it's just like the body gets conditioned to be a little haywire. So what happens is with a panic attack is it's biological, it's physical in terms of your somatic parts of your body and your brain. And there's a conversation that goes back and forth between the two that usually people are privy to. So for example, someone might start to get stressed and they notice that their body is doing something that's similar to a panic attack that they've had before. And so they start to worry, am I going to have a panic attack? Is this going to happen now? Where am I? Can I get out of here? Are there people around? And they start to worry about that. And like, oh man, I'm really scared I'm going to have a panic attack. Is it getting worse? Is it going to be a panic attack? And then they kind of like mentally look down at their heart and like, oh no, it's going faster. It's going faster. I think I'm going to have a panic attack. What's going to happen? And then they worry for a little more and they're like, oh gosh, my heart's going even faster. So you can see how this conversation is perpetuating itself, right? The worry about the heart going faster makes the heart going faster, which makes more worry, which makes the heart go faster, for example. So that's kind of what happens during a panic attack. This is in people who've had a few panic attacks, and it depends on where and when those happen. So like I said, most of us have a panic attack in our life. And if we're worried about having more and have a fear of it, then we start to hyper monitor our body. And then we, you know, get scared that they might happen again. And that again, self-fulfilling prophecy, so to speak. But panic attacks can look pretty different. I mentioned the heart, increased heart rate, increased breathing, sweating. Sometimes people feel like they're having, like the world around them is not real. Like it's not, like they're in it, but it's not real. It's almost like a dream or something like that. And that's just our brains having a thing going on. Like certain drugs and stuff will give a similar experience to that, but this is real scary. And people might shake, they sweat, you know, all of that activity of the fight or flight system is basically what's happening. It doesn't have to be triggered. It can be random, but usually our brain, which is really good at this, wants to find a reason for it. So if we have a panic attack, our brain is like, well, we had this and this happened and this, so let's stay away from those things. And that's what makes panic attacks worse. We start to avoid things, and then we might have another panic attack, and then that tells us, well, we're avoiding so good, we better avoid more stuff. And before you know it, you're stuck at home and you're afraid to go out places because you're afraid of having a panic attack. So that's kind of what happens. In terms of like what causes them, we don't have a greatest idea of like how we could keep people from ever having a panic attack. And with 60-some% of people having a panic attack in their life, it's just something the body does. It's just something the body does now and then. Our response to it is what turns it into something that's repeated and can turn it into panic disorder. Now, some people are just going to have repeated panic attacks. It's just something their body does. If they respond in ways that are not avoidance and fear and that kind of thing, they're like, my body's lying to me. It's freaking out for no reason. This is a horrible experience. It feels terrible, but it's not. I'm not going to die. This is going to be fine. Hopefully I won't have another one anytime soon. That's fine. That's just our body being weird. But if we become concerned about it, start avoiding things, have more panic attacks, then that's panic disorder. So it will not, how's the body affected is this question. Panic attacks are not dangerous. They feel dangerous because there's a lot of fear attached to them. that's stimulating fear centers in our brain, but they are not dangerous. They will not kill you. The challenge is understanding when is it a panic attack? When is it a cardiac issue? When is it, you know, most people have had heart attacks can tell the difference between a heart attack and a panic attack. But if you've only had panic attacks and don't know what a heart attack feels like, it can be hard to tell the difference. So a lot of times people with panic disorder end up going to the emergency room a few times, having it determined that there's nothing wrong with their heart. And then hopefully they end up in my office because I'm really good at treating panic disorder. And you, as you may have guessed from my prior answers, the way to treat panic attacks and panic disorder is to have a better relationship with the feared stimuli. So if someone has a lot of hyperventilation, they breathe really fast when they have a panic attack, then we help them to exert control over that. We help them to hyperventilate in the room safely, in a way that it would feel during the panic attack. So they can feel those sensations and know that they're not dangerous. And so that teaches their brain, these sensations suck. They're awful, but they're not dangerous. So when they come up, I can tolerate them, I can keep doing what I'm doing, and they'll eventually go away. And I do this with patients. So, and it does suck. Like, sit for hyperventilate, which is breathe in and out real fast. So do that for like 30 seconds. It sucks. You'll feel lightheaded. You might feel a little nauseous. You'll feel bad. That's one piece of a panic attack. So you can imagine how bad panic attacks feel. But for people that have panic, that is a horrifying experience to have all those things happen together. So we give them a safe place in my office or in my therapy room where they can do that exercise and realize that, hey, this is not going to kill me. This is okay. Now, I don't just toss them into it. They understand all the background to it. And we don't even touch that until we've seen each other for like two or three sessions. But that is a very, very, very effective treatment for panic disorder. And again, we're just changing that relationship between our mind and what those symptoms mean. Because what we think a panic attack means is certain death, and I'm going to go crazy, I'm going to lose it. But what it actually means is, this is my body being weird, going off in this way because evolution made it so that our physiology is reactive so we can avoid dying to, you know, things like saber-toothed tigers and whatnot. All right, next question. What is the direct correlation between addiction and mental health? So addiction is a term that is not always used within psychology and mental health, but sometimes is. When it comes to mental health, we have something called substance use disorder. That is the mental health diagnosis that is associated with addiction. And substance use disorder means the person has a pattern of problematic use that is interfering with their life in some ways, and that they have perhaps tried to cut down and not been able to, and that this there's some substance associated with that. They spend a lot of their time trying to get that substance. There are various criteria, and you don't need very many of them to meet criteria for substance use disorder. Basically, you're using a substance, you can't stop, and that interferes. That would usually be termed as addiction, but addiction can be different. Also, when the term addiction is used, often the only treatment considered is abstinence. And there are many other treatments in abstinence. We call them harm reduction or moderation. And for a lot of people, those things kind of work. Now, we're not going to do moderation for things like heroin or fentanyl, where you can die from one dosage. And especially not when they're drugs that are like that powerful. But for things like alcohol, marijuana, and things like that, you know, we can, if someone has a substance use disorder associated with that, we can sometimes help work with them to reach a level of use that works for them, that is not dangerous, does not interfere with their life, but doesn't necessarily mean they have to completely abstain. So that's the difference. Abstinence is indicated, like I said, in a lot of situations. For some people, abstinence is the best treatment for an alcohol use disorder, but it's not the only treatment. So, next question. Does a mental health disorder like OCD have to be linked back to or caused by something that happens in early childhood, or can it present later on in life seemingly out of nowhere? Well, nothing comes out of nowhere. There's always a collection of factors that cause it. So sometimes that could include early childhood experiences. Sometimes it does not. No disorder has to be linked to early childhood experiences. Some manifest in childhood, like autism spectrum and that kind of thing. That is manifests in early childhood. It starts in early childhood, but it's not due to early childhood experiences. It's not due to childhood trauma or abuse or anything like that. But they don't come out of nowhere. So people with OCD tend to have a predisposition. It's a pretty rare disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. It's pretty rare. And so for rare ones, most of the time, there's some kind of genetic predisposition that people have to have, or some kind of physiological predisposition. Their brain has to work in a certain way for those experiences later to cause OCD. So you have to have the combination of environmental stimuli and a predisposition to get OCD. So not everyone can get OCD is what I'm saying. Now there's something called obsessive compulsive personality disorder that is linked to a preference for order, really liking things in a certain way and that kind of stuff. That is a personality disorder that's different. So those are like obsessive compulsive, those are more compulsive, I'd say, behaviors, but those are, that's a separate thing. Obsessive compulsive disorder usually involves like more magical thinking and more kind of odd or nonsensical beliefs about what their behavior could do. So for example, someone believing that if they organize their pencils in a certain way in school, then they'll get better grades. But if they don't organize their pencils that way, their grades will be worse. So that is nonsensical. It's called magical thinking is one of the ways that we term it. And most people who have OCD will say, well, yeah, I understand that probably doesn't influence my grade. It's not going to magically influence my grade. But what if there's like a 1% chance that if I don't have my pencils this way, it'll distract me and then I'll get a worse grade. So I'm just going to organize my pencils that way anyway. So that's, if you really press someone, that's where you usually get with OCD. And there's a lot of anxiety that they experience around changing those obsessions and not acting on those compulsions. So that can develop for a multitude of reasons, but it looks like there needs to be a predisposition and probably some kind of stressor or things like that. And that people respond to stress by developing obsessions and compulsions. And so the more stress they experience, the more obsessions and compulsions, or the stronger they are going to develop those as ways of coping. So, but again, have to have that predisposition, I think, for that. So yeah, not necessarily due to early childhood trauma or anything like that, although that certainly could be the stressor. So that's not necessary, but possible. Good question. Yeah. Modern psychology doesn't link everything back to stuff that happened when we were kids. That's just antiquated way of thinking. Great question. Last question. What are some early signs that someone might be struggling with their mental health, even if they seem fine on the outside? For this, I would say major changes in behavior, especially social behaviors, are probably one of the best indicators. So beyond people just like struggling, beyond people like saying like I'm sad more often, or I feel down, or I don't feel like doing this anymore, or something like that. Beyond that, I would say the things that maybe those are things that basically people are telling you, like I'm not feeling so good mentally. So beyond those, the ones that the person and the may not even be aware of themselves, I would say look for things like social withdrawal. So people who don't want to hang out anymore, they'd rather spend time alone. And those kinds of things. That's a big one that I think is a big sign. And then major changes in emotionality. So if someone tends to be like cool and collected and they start flying off the handle a lot more often, that might be something. If someone is usually kind and then they're getting kind of mean and snippy, then that might be something. No, they could just be under a lot of stress. But we're talking about mental health in general here, and I'd say being burnout or overstressed is a mental health issue. It's not necessarily a diagnostic one that you can diagnose, but I'd say it's a mental health issue. So including all of these things, but I would, social withdrawal, I think, is the one that people would notice in other people the most. And then maybe having them like be more negative and speak more negatively and that kind of thing. I'm a pretty cynical human, so I think my friends would worry about me if I was being less cynical. But also if I got like super more cynical, because usually I at least have a sense of humor and a way of being like, hey, this is, you know, this is just the way it is. then, like, if I didn't show that in addition to my cynicism and it was just all cynicism, which would also make me a real bummer, then I think that would be a clue to my friends that I was struggling with my mental health. But I would probably just tell them first. Looking for support. Well, thank you for listening. Those are all the anonymous questions. If you're in my class, I hope I answered your question well, but our further work this summer session will definitely answer your question even better if it hasn't been already. And for other listeners, thanks for listening in. If you've listened to these before, you've probably seen some patterns in the questions people ask, but there's always some really lovely ones that questions that come from stuff that's happening around us. And I always appreciate giving a chance to have a little small audience here to tell those things to. So thank you very much. This is Dr. Whited. Check out dohealthybehealthy.com if you want to see some cool exercises for your mental health or keep abreast of some of these things. And I promise you someday I will find the time to do some of the cool little podcast sessions that I want to do again, other than these anonymous survey ones. But these anonymous survey ones are still going to be one of my favorite ones to do because I really enjoy answering these questions that people bring to me. So take care, everyone. Take care of yourselves.